degrees that you have?
Four.
Plus the one. Okay. Before returning to graduate school to get her fourth, she wrote for the London Free Press, the Globe and Mail, and Maclean Hunter Publications, and was also part of the team that started the Discovery Channel Canada in 1995. She earned a PhD, so that would be her fourth, in history of medicine from the University of Toronto in 2000, and then went on to complete a two-year postdoctoral fellowship at the Wellcome Unit for the History of Medicine at the University of Oxford. In addition to her academic work, Marianne also serves as a communications consultant, and this is how I met Marianne. She specializes in education and science, and most recently she has been working with Quantum Works, Canada's quantum information network, in which I was involved, which has its headquarters here in Waterloo. So she was frequently visiting us at the Institute and at Quantum Works in Waterloo. So thank you very much for accepting this job, Marianne.
Thank you very much, Anne. And I, too, am very excited, and I've been told that this other mic will be turned off, so I won't get feedback. So you're probably looking at these five women seated here at the table who have consented to join us today for a panel and give us the benefit of their experiences in the world of science, broadly construed, in fact. And I'd just briefly like to introduce them all to you, starting from your left, my right. Dr. Catherine Kalin completed her undergraduate degree in physics and mathematics at UBC. You can let out a cheer. If I mention any of the institutions, you can let out a cheer and show your support. Then she went on to Harvard University for her PhD in physics. She was a postdoc at the Kavli Institute for Theoretical Physics in Santa Barbara before joining the faculty at McMaster University in 1986. She spent sabbaticals at Bell Labs, Cornell, UBC, Stanford, and KITP, has held Sloan, Stacey, and Guggenheim fellowships, and is a fellow of the American Physical Society and of the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, or CIFAR, as we call it, around these parts. She holds a Canada Research Chair in Quantum Materials Theory at McMaster. Her research focuses on novel electron behavior in materials, including superconductors, frustrated magnets, my personal favorite phrase, and quantum Hall systems. Seated beside her is Adriana Predoy-Cross, who received her combined bachelor and master's degree in engineering physics in 1990 from the University of Bucharest in Romania. Following 2 years at the Institute of Optoelectronics in Bucharest, she joined the physics department at the University of New Brunswick. And I know there's somebody here from UNB in the audience. And she joined there as a PhD student. In 1997, she obtained a PhD in molecular spectroscopy and became a postdoctoral fellow in the atmospheric physics group at the University of Toronto. She spent nearly 3 years working on spectroscopic projects with applications to remote sensing, leading to the development of new techniques of spectroscopic analysis. In 2000, Adriana joined the product line management at JDS Uniphase in Ottawa. Adriana returned to academia in 2003 as a sessional lecturer at the University of Ottawa, as well as at Carleton University. And then, that's it, that's the spirit. In July 2003, she joined the Department of Physics and Astronomy at, and I expect to hear a big one because I know there are a number of you from this institution, the University of Lethbridge. they're shy in Lethbridge, in southern Alberta. She's received an NSERC University Faculty Award and has written extensively on the issue of women in science. Her research focuses on analysis of atmospheric trace gases, industrial process monitoring and controlling, and basic investigations of molecular structures. The reason I'm giving you these lengthy bios is just, again, one of the purposes of this gathering is to network. So if you're interested in pursuing a degree at one of the institutions that one of the panelists has attended, or interested in their research, or perhaps in getting links into industrial collaborations, please don't hesitate to go up and speak to the panelists after the talk. Dr. Sarah Chandra, who is seated in the middle, received her undergraduate degrees in math and physics from the University of Arizona and her PhD in physics from Cornell in 2006. Sarah was a postdoc at the Institute for Strings, Cosmology, and Astroparticle Physics at Columbia before joining PI, the Perimeter Institute, as a postdoc in the cosmology group. This fall, she returns to the U.S. as an assistant professor of physics at Pennsylvania State University, also known as Penn State. Sarah works on ideas for describing the very early universe when high-energy particle physics and gravity both played important roles. She also explores ways to test those ideas using observations of the universe as we see it today. Beside Sarah is Dr. Ilse Tronicht. She's the CEO of the Mars Discovery District, a leading innovation center located in Toronto, right on College Street, right downtown. She oversees both the development and operations of the Mars Center and its broad suite of entrepreneurship and innovation programs. Ilse has worked closely with the leadership of Toronto's academic institutions and their teaching hospitals to create Mars Innovation, an integrated commercialization platform for 14 different Toronto institutions, and served as the interim managing director for a year following its formal launch in 2008. Ilse joined Mars in early 2005, having been president and CEO of Primaxis Technology Ventures, a startup stage venture capital fund focused on advanced technologies. Prior to Primaxis, Ilse was an entrepreneur with senior management roles in a number of emerging technology companies. She's an active member of Canada's innovation community and has served on the boards of private companies, industry associations, and research organizations. And she was one of the women invited to the first ever federal summit on the issue of women in science and engineering held this past November in Ottawa. Ilse holds a DPhil in chemistry from Oxford, which she attended as a Rhodes Scholar. And in 2009, she was inducted into the Women's Executive Network's Canada's Most Powerful Women Top 100 Hall of Fame. And finally, on your immediate right is Dr. Melanie Campbell, who earned a BSc in Chemical Physics and an MSc in Physics at UW before traveling to Sydney, Australia, where she finished a PhD in Applied Mathematics and Physiology at the Australian National University. Following a Cicero Fellowship at the Institute of Mathematics and Statistics in Canberra, Melanie returned to Canada with an NSERC University Research Fellowship. She's currently a professor of physics and astronomy in the School of Optometry at the University of Waterloo. She studies eye development. Well, that just pause a moment for that woo-hoo. She studies eye development, eye disease, and linear and nonlinear optics of the eye, and is known for her work on the gradient index optics of crystalline lens, its changes with aging, and effects of visual experience on its refractive index distribution. She's developed and patented improved scanning laser and polarization methods for imaging the eye and biological tissues. Melanie has also collaborated in the first real-time images of cones at the rear of the eye, using adaptive optics, and recently discovered putative optical signals to eye growth, which appear to follow a circadian rhythm. She uses ultrafast lasers to study highly localized light-activated therapies for eye disease. She's a fellow of the Optical Society of America, fellow of the Institute of Physics in the UK, holds an honorary professional physicist designation. You can speak to her about that. And is a former president of the Canadian Association of Physicists, and she shared the 2004 Rank Prize in Optoelectronics. She was also co-founder of Biomedical Photometrics, Inc., now known as Huron Technologies. So please join me in welcoming these panelists. Now, as part of the context, being a historian, and I ask you to be kind to me as sort of an outside observer of the phenomenon known as getting an advanced degree in the sciences, I just wanted to let you know that what we'll be talking about today has been talked about before. And in fact, in 1995, there was a committee. It was called the Committee to Encourage Women in Physics. I like that. It's sort of encouraged. It's sort of, yes, you can do it. We know we can do it. But how can we grow our numbers, for instance? Well, they sponsored a survey of Canadian college and university physics departments. And the findings revealed that between 1993 and 95, 18% of the Bachelor of Science degrees and 13% of the PhDs in physics were granted to women. Only 5% of the faculty and 2% of tenured faculty in physics were women. By 1998-2001, the situation had improved slightly, 22%, so up 4%. of the bachelor's degrees, and 15%, again, just up 2%, were granted to women, and a whole 8% of faculty, but still only 5% of tenured faculty in physics were women. So what is happening to the individuals that study, and where is the, as they call it, the supply chain dropping off? This led, in fact, to a number of recommendations from the first ever international conference on women in physics held at the Maison de l'UNESCO in Paris, France in 2002. And one of their recommendations was to do exactly what we're doing today and over the next 2 days. And that was to create, support, and encourage networks for women physicists, local, national, international, including a worldwide e-network, and create women in physics web pages in each country with links to each other and to information on successful strategies and programs. Provide a well-publicized international web presence for women in physics. Finally, I mentioned the report that came out in November in Canada, and that's a wider report on women in science, broadly construed, so the biological sciences and life sciences, chemical sciences, as well as the physical sciences and mathematics. And in that study, this is how many, you don't have to raise your hands, I'm not trying to embarrass anyone, but anybody who's born around 1985 should listen to this because you were probably counted in this group. They traced a group of school children from grade one up until 2009 when, if they chose to pursue an advanced degree in science and engineering, they were enrolled. The odds of a female child enrolled in the first grade in 1985, completing a PhD in science or engineering was deemed to be 1 in 286. For a boy, it's 1 in 167. And in fact, of the 185,116 girls enrolled in grade 1 in 1985, there were a mere 647 who had completed or were in the process of completing their PhD in science and engineering. Good news, bad news? If you're feeling a little lonely in the physical sciences, you're alone. I'm confirming that. But in fact, the number of women in the physical sciences, in life sciences, you know that there are twice as many. There are a whole 7%. And that actually, sorry, that it grew by 7% from 43% to 50%. So there's parity. Within the math and physical sciences, the growth rate was slower, 3%, from 27% to 30%. But next time you have a friend who's a woman in engineering, shake her hand because she's probably relatively much lonelier. In engineering and computer science, those numbers grew, again, only by 3% from 17 to 20%. So to the rest of this, that's basically a little bit of background to let you know that this question has been asked by women around the world. Why are the numbers so low in the physical sciences? It continues to be asked. It's of concern to Canadian researchers. But for the rest of this, for the rest of the time we spend together, I'm only going to pose one question and then open it up to the floor. Some of you have sent questions in on the Facebook page. And the question I asked our panelists to consider was, can you describe a particular challenge you faced in your career because you're a woman and how you addressed that challenge? And it might not have been apparent to you, of course you know you're a woman, but you might not have thought, well, this is a challenge just because I'm a woman, but how it may have played out in the fullness of time that it was your womanness or your femaleness that was at issue. So if I can just move my way down the panel, and then I will read the questions that have been submitted by you to the Facebook page, and then open it up to the floor.
Should I start?
Please.
Okay. Well, first I'd just like to welcome you all here and say what a pleasure it is to be surrounded by so many young women who are interested in physics. It's inspiring to me. So I'm married to a physicist, and so I thought I'd talk about the challenge of finding two faculty jobs together. This is actually not such an unusual challenge for women in physics because a lot of us are married to physicists. Not all of us, but a lot of us. In my own department at McMaster, there's seven women faculty, and five of us are married to physicists. So you can see it really isn't that uncommon. So my husband, who's here, John Berlinski, and I, we had a definite goal, which was finding two faculty jobs that allowed us to live together and gave us the research environment that we needed. And our approach was to just attack this directly. We went on the market as a couple, so our applications made it clear that we were looking for two jobs. Other people, other women approached this differently. I know some that approached it as just looking for jobs independently and then perhaps bringing in the spouse at a later stage. But we took this direct approach, and we had an extra challenge in that our daughter was only a few months old when we were at the interview stage. That's Anne, and she's also here in the audience. and she was actually breastfeeding at that time, and so the only practical way we could handle this is actually all three of us went to interviews, and so the three of us flew multiple times across North America as we were looking for jobs. And this was in the mid-80s in Canada. I think at that time you could count the number of women faculty members in physics departments in Canada on a single hand. And so I think, you know, our primary goal was to get a job in Canada, although we also looked and interviewed in the U.S. And we certainly encountered a diverse range of responses as to, you know, how departments handled our interview with the three of us arriving. And perhaps not surprisingly, there was actually a strong correlation between how well they handled it from our perspective and the end result of whether they offered us a faculty job. In the end, we had several offers to choose from, and we chose McMaster, which was by far the most welcoming department. They just did a stellar job of dealing with some of the challenges that came up of having a young baby at the interview, and even, you know, scheduling breastfeeding, during the two-day interview session and that. And they also provided us with the research opportunities that we needed. And so although, people might argue that if you look for jobs independently, you may have more offers to choose from, and I think that's true, but our approach, we learned a lot about the attitudes of the departments we visited and what kind of environment we were likely to experience if we moved there. And I think that was a very valuable learning experience because, for us at least, that was very important. I don't think we would have had such a happy and productive career if we weren't in such a welcoming environment.
Thank you, Kathy. Adriana.
First, I'd like to thank the conference organizers for this opportunity. The challenge that I want to talk about is the challenge of being both an academic and a parent, and also a spouse of another physicist in a different scenario than the one described to you. I'd like to say that I encountered gender discrimination for the first time when I got pregnant with my third child. It's very personal, but my department chair pretty much told me that I destroyed my career by getting pregnant. And I'd like to share with you how I proved him wrong. No, it's true that for most women, the childbearing age corresponds with probably the peak of our careers, and we are either postdoctoral fellows or we are just starting an academic career, and there are the years when we should work very hard, and motherhood doesn't always fit in perfectly. In my case, two of my kids were born when I was an academic, and I wouldn't have succeeded if it wasn't for my spouse, who's also a physicist, and some arrangements we made in our family for shared time, for taking care of the children, for just dividing the duties, so the parenting duties between us. I mentioned I'm married to another physicist. When I joined University of Lethbridge, we only had one offer, and for him, it was impossible to offer him another 10-year track position. He came on a term position. He took a chance and believed in the promises that were made at the time of hiring. We all have heard stories when such promises don't become true. In our case, after 3 years of term positions, he was actually offered the opportunity to apply for a tenure track position. So in the process of going through this, we also had three children to take care of, and that's the challenge that I wanted to share with you.
Thank you, Adriana.
Okay, I'd also like to thank Sarah and Anne, especially for organizing this event. It's very exciting to see you all. And I guess for the record, just so you get the statistics, I'm also attached to a physicist, but and I won't talk about that. So I want to talk about something that's actually been very difficult for me, and I want to preface this by saying that I don't think it happens to everyone. I did my PhD in high-energy theoretical physics, which I think is especially known for a certain kind of attitude. So this may very well not be your experience, but if it is, I thought I'd tell you what happened. And the difficult thing for me was often the experience of meeting colleagues for the first time, especially at conferences, and having them essentially not consider me part of the conversation. So they would essentially stand around talking but assume that I wasn't in the conversation somehow, or if I said something, no one would really pay attention. And that's extremely frustrating. And my first response was to get angry, which isn't very productive. And so I guess what I'd recommend if this happens to you is that you make some effort to show that you're in the conversation in some legitimate way. But if after a couple of tries that's not working, you can walk away, because there are enough decent people in this field, even among high-energy theorists, that will talk to you, that you really don't have to deal with that. And I think that's what I didn't appreciate early on. I thought I had to make sure that every single person, you know, my age appreciated me. And it's not true. I mean, of course, you do want to make a good, you know, impression on everyone that you meet, and you want to make sure that you make mentors and make good connections, but there are enough decent people that you just don't have to deal with it. So if it's hard to deal with, go find somebody else who actually appreciates you and make sure you make the most of those relationships that are actually working.
Thank you, Sarah. Bill?
Thanks very much for having me here, and I apologize for being the chemist and a rusty chemist at this table. I thought I would just touch on sort of very briefly on sort of three weird situations, because my career is not in academe. The first was kind of a funny one. I grew up in South Africa and went to Balliol College at Oxford in 1979, and it was the first year that women were admitted to this college. So 9 women arrived from all over the world at this college, and although it wasn't an overtly hostile environment, it ranged from baffled to quietly resentful to just awkward. And I have to say, the group of 9 women, and it was very much the collective personality of that cohort, tackled this problem by just completely charming the entire college. And it was led by a wonderful physicist from Australia. So I have fond memories of that. We put 9 women into a boat and won the river, and that endeared us to our male colleagues. After my postdoc, I joined a startup out of the University of Toronto in the green chemistry field. And unlike the stories you've heard, the company hired me when I was 4 months pregnant. It was a very small startup company, so no HR policies, no HR department, you know, no formal structure, enormous pressure because the company was on a very steep ramp. A group of very old school aggressive investors came into the company at the time that I was hired, and their way of dealing with the fact that I was day by day obviously more pregnant was to promote me right before I delivered, which meant that I would have to come back 2 weeks after the baby was born. And my confession is that I was stupid enough to do it and brought the baby with me to the company. And it was a very bizarre experience. And I often think back, you know, what was I thinking? Obviously, I was part of a generation that just thought you would have a baby and life would go on. But I've learned since having four children. The final environment I worked in, a bunch of tech startups, the final reference point I just want to give you is I became somewhat by accident a venture capitalist, as you heard, prior to taking on my role at Mars. And the seed stage fund that we ran, two of the four partners were women, which was a complete anomaly in the Canadian venture capital industry, and in fact is a complete anomaly in the global venture capital industry. And I have to tell you, although I've worked in many, many technology-based environments, I have never encountered an environment that is so positively hostile to women as the venture capital sector. And so so that's a topic that, you know, I'm happy to explore, but it was a real eye-opener for me. Because if you look at the financial services sector more broadly, you see a lot of senior women. But in terms of the decision-making base that of investors that are placing bets on Canada's future high-growth companies, there's a huge amount of work to be done.
Thank you.
I am going to touch on some of the same themes that others have. First, I should say thank you to the organizers as well, because I think it is important that as we recognize the issues that women face, that we attempt to do a little bit to change those issues and to improve things for those who come behind us, and so thank you to the organizers. I am a physicist who is married to a non-physicist, and I think there may be a little more flexibility in my life sometimes because of that. I wanted to talk about the expectations of the role of female and the role of physicist, and not so much necessarily my expectations, but everybody else's expectations. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it was because of the article in Maclean's recently about the woman in engineering, the student at Waterloo, who posed in her bikini next to one of the cars that they were entering in a competition. How many of you saw the Maclean's article? Okay, so a few of you have seen it. And one of the comments made in that article, which really for me touched on a point that I think is important, is that she posed in part because she wasn't comfortable with her role as a female and her role as an engineering student. And that struck me as very sad that that's still the case. It was certainly the case. It wasn't the case for me personally early on, but it could easily have been the case. So, for instance, when I started my PhD at ANU in the Applied Mathematics Department and later over in the Physiology Department, I was the first female student in that, postgraduate student in that department. And initially it was just, you know, somewhat funny. You know, I got a kind of a laugh out of some of the comments. So when I would walk into the tea room and the air would be blue and, you know, then they'd be uncomfortable because all of a sudden there was a female present, they would say things like, well, for the purposes of this conversation, Melanie, you're male. And then they would go on and the air would remain blue. And, you know, so those were the sorts of things that went on. And there was great puzzlement about the fact that I had come to do a PhD in Australia, and as my supervisor said to me, well, it's perfectly understandable that you would come alone. It's perfectly understandable that your husband would come with you if he had something to come to, like another degree in Australia, but that he would follow you and then find a job after you arrived in Australia. I mean, that's just weird. And so, you know, it was very evident that people weren't comfortable with my role as a female and as a physicist, but it didn't really make a big impression on my own self-image until my first pregnancy, and that was greeted with surprise, astonishment, I think. And I realized that the people around me had expected that in becoming a physicist and being a female, I'd somehow entered a monastery and become a nun, and I was never going to have a husband, and I was never going to have children, and I'd never considered that there was a choice like that. So, you know, it was a bit awkward, and I then began to have doubts, and so about my ability to juggle, you know, a family life and being a physicist. And it was my husband who then came to the rescue and sat me down one day and said, but you love what you do. You know, however tough it is to come back to it after you have a baby, you love it and you'll come back to it. And you know, I was forever grateful to him for actually doing that and you know, and sitting me down and reassuring me that, you know, everything would work out. And then, of course, it did work out, but partly from his support, because there was no maternity leave for postdocs, and I was a postdoc at the time I was pregnant with my first child. And so I had to negotiate my maternity leave from scratch, and to this day I'm also very happy about the administrator at CSIRO, who is my model administrator forever. He said to me, he said, "You don't have to know our regulations." He said, "All you have to do is tell me what you want to do, and I will look up the regulations, and I will find a way to make it happen. That's my job as an administrator. You're a scientist. You tell me what you want. I make it happen." And that's my model. I wish all administrators were like that. It's unfortunate they're not, but I wish they were. And then, you know, the same thing happened during my second pregnancy here in Waterloo, that I had an NSERC fellowship, and as the NSERC person on the phone said to me, "We've never really expected females to take these fellowships, and we've certainly never had one who was pregnant before." and you know, that was a bit astounding to me. And again, I had to negotiate the terms of my pregnancy. But, you know, NSERC then turned around after I'd had the baby and pointed out that this shouldn't have been quite as difficult as it was. They put me on a committee to work out maternity leaves for postgrads and graduate students and fellowship holders. And so that would be my other advice to you, is that when something affects you, if you can find sympathetic people, make it known, because you can have an impact in changing the system for those that follow. You can, you know, help to change the policies. During my tenure on that committee, actually, I didn't make a lot of progress in the 6 years I was on that committee, but within a year of my leaving the committee, this momentum had certainly started, and there now are maternity and maternity leaves for graduate students who hold NSERC scholarships and CIHR scholarships, and leaves for postdocs, and paid for by the agencies that fund those scholarships. And I'm very proud of my part in that. But it's still difficult, I think, to realize that there is a perception that the two roles are somehow different and that it's hard to combine them. And I think it's unfortunate that the perception of a physicist is in some ways so rigid. I think it's even unfortunate for the males, because as people on that committee said to me, if we have more flexibility in how we view a physicist and a scientist, then not only will we attract more women to physics and to science, but we will also attract more men, the men who don't feel they fit with the stereotype of what a physicist is. And so I think that working towards family-friendly policies, working against stereotypical views of what a scientist is very important, not just to females, but to males as well. And most recently, actually, I helped to negotiate a new parental leave policy at the University of Waterloo, because it's just as important to males who value their family life as it is to females. And so that would be my advice to you, you know, that you can make a difference, and that a lot of the issues you face will be faced by your male colleagues as well, and you'll find some sympathy amongst them as well about these issues.
Thank you very much. And now to our first question, which came through on the Facebook page. A recent online search for patents relating to quantum information processing yielded many patents. 40 scientist inventors were named, but only one of them was a woman, 2.5%. This is even lower representation. This is an even lower representation of women than that in my field, which generally tends to be about 10%. The question I put to the panel on behalf of the person asking the question is there something that discourages women from applying for patents? Sorry, yeah. Melanie?
I have applied for patents, and I hold an issued patent, two issued patents. I would say that it's one more thing, you know, to add to the list of things that you're trying to do. If you're an academic, you're teaching, you're doing research, you're doing a certain amount of administration, and then you add into that writing a patent, which perhaps isn't recognized the same way as writing a paper. And so, you know, I think academics are busier and busier, and it's very difficult to find the time to add that to what you do. So first of all, it's easier if it's an expectation of your department or your field, and in my case it became obvious to me that it was one of the few ways to get your work used sort of more generally, is to actually hold a patent. But I would say that's the barrier, just that it's one additional thing on top of everything else that you're attempting to do.
Ilsa, based on your work at Mars, do you have anything?
Interesting question. I mean, patents obviously originate from a number of different places, academe being one, but corporate R&D labs being another very significant contributor. And certainly those would still, in the hard sciences, be largely dominated by males. The sort of window that I have through our work with startups and at Mars, we're very focused on including females, and one of, I think, our biggest accomplishments now is that our entrepreneurship education programs are 50-50 male-female in attendance. But if you look at the young companies, over sort of 700 that we work with today, so these are in clean tech, life sciences, IT, entertainment, so web-based companies as well as... Only about 6% of them have women as founders or significant senior members of the founding teams. So, and as much as patents, you know, are generated by founders who take those into young startup companies, I think that is a very alarming statistic. And it's the other irony is it's not just true in Canada; it's true in Silicon Valley. So. There's a huge gender imbalance in the startup technology world, which is where a lot of new intellectual property make its way to the market.
Thank you. Would anyone else on the panel like to comment? So I'll move on to the next question. It has a few parts. It starts off, is physics inherently political? If a few key scientists think a researcher's work has no value, a matter of opinion rather than whether or not the research is truly valid, will that researcher's work be deemed useless and no longer garner any funding? Can the opinions of a few key scientists destroy a researcher's chance to research a topic or to pursue a certain avenue of research?
I'll say something. I think most human endeavors have politics in it, but I actually think that physics maybe has somewhat less politics than many other endeavors, including even than some other sciences like medical research, I would think, has more politics. And I think, you know, part of it is, maybe it's shared with mathematics, and that, there's real right answers and wrong answers. And if you have a right answer, you know, the community will come to realize that, and it's recognized. And, someone that's powerful can't really take that away from you. Certainly there is a politics that can enter, and certainly, you want to avoid making enemies if you can. But I'd say physics, I think, has a lot less politics in many endeavors.
Hey, sure, Melanie.
Well, I think it's important to realize that physics is a critically based science, so that you're almost expected to be your own worst critic when you're, say, applying for grant funds, so that you've actually looked at whatever your idea is, you've looked at the pros and cons, the alternate theories, and that you've set up a way that you can actually prove or disprove your particular theory. So I think that there's fundamentally more than an idea or more than a thought involved. There's a whole structure that you have to put in place when you're making some proposal, say, for money, or when you're being reviewed for an article you've written. There is an onus on the person who's being critical of your work to actually give valid reasons. And in most cases, there is an opportunity for rebuttal. So if you get a review on a paper you've submitted for publication, if in some way the person who's criticizing your work is clearly wrong, then you get a chance to tell the editor that, to point out why you think they're wrong and to give additional references. The grant situation, it depends on the granting agency whether you get a chance to resubmit or to rebut the actual criticisms made. So that depends very much on the situation. But there is give and take, and there is usually some way in which you can in turn rebut whatever the criticism is of your work. But I would advise that in physics, I think you're expected to be your own worst critic to start with. And the more critical you are of your own thought process, the less likely someone else is to find a hole in it.
Maybe I can just add there's probably a very famous example that most people might be aware of, because in theoretical physics, the farther you get from experiment, right, and observational evidence, the harder it is to make a compelling case that your ideas are right. And so people probably know that there's been some trends in the high energy theory community between, you know, do we do string theory, do we do loop quantum gravity, this kind of thing. And that is to some extent political, of course, because once a large, you know, train of people start moving in one direction, lots of people get attracted to the train and it goes off with a lot of momentum. But I think even though that's been sort of a well-publicized debate, I think it's also been true that there have been people exploring lots of other alternatives, and those people have been funded. So it's not, you know, it's been maybe, it's important to talk about the sociology of these things, but I think in reality, lots of ideas have been explored, you know, with different evidence. So it's really not, there is politics, but it's really not a killer. You're not going to get, your idea isn't going to get crushed just because it's not in the mainstream.
And maybe I could add another thought on that. A lot of the granting agencies are aware of this problem, that working on something that's popular will happen more easily because of the way the whole sociology works. So when I'm a reviewer at grant agencies now, there is a category that a lot of them now encourage called high risk, high payoff. So if the research really is completely novel and innovative and outside, you know, what everyone else is doing, then that's credited as long as it's seen that the potential payoff of the research is also has a huge impact. So most agencies I understand are establishing this area of research, high risk, high payoff.
Thank you. Any other comments? The next question is, I'm interested in opportunities within biological physics in relation to the application of physics to neurology. Can anyone on the panel speak to this? And I know that Melanie has already answered on the Facebook page, but if anyone else wishes to speak to opportunities sort of branching over to other sciences.
Well, maybe just in a general sense, you know, that it's an area I think that has huge potential for young scientists, young entrepreneurs, as well as I think a unique opportunity for Canada. If we can somehow really mine some of these convergence areas in a way that will position us at the leading edge of both new areas of research, but also new categories of products and markets, and obviously the life sciences more broadly has huge pull internationally. So it's a very significant opportunity. Sometimes it's a bit challenging to find the right intersections to ramp on. But I think Canada has a long-standing history also of encouraging those cross-fertilizations between disciplines with the work of CIFAR and others. So.
Yep. Yeah, I'll just briefly mention that I guess in our own department we have a small group in biophysics, one of whom is a woman physicist, Cecile Fradin. And so she was trained as a condensed matter physicist at the PhD level, so actually there wasn't any biology in her PhD training, but she did a postdoc at Tel Aviv where she knew that she was interested in moving in that direction and worked in biophysics, and I mean, she's now a very well-established biophysicist. So I think, you know, physicists often make a transition into biology-inspired areas, going into different depths. I'd say Cecile is very deep into it in that, you know, her papers are published in the journals that biologists read, and that, but she still comes at it from her physics background, and I think that's a very valuable contribution to that area.
Thank you. Adriana.
I think that many female students are attracted towards areas of applied science where they have the opportunity to interact with other people, and answering more directly the question, I just want to give an example. At my university, we have both a department of physics and a department of neuroscience. And the department of neuroscience has at least two professors that are physicists, and they are cross-appointed in physics. So it is possible to have a graduate degree, for example, either from physics and do the work with a co-supervisor in neuroscience, or to be based in the neuroscience department, which obviously has different requirements for graduate studies, and do a lot of more physics-oriented projects. It really, if somebody is interested in this, exploring this type of research areas, we can be of help and maybe offer some guidance.
Thank you very much. The next question is, it's a biggie, so prepare yourselves. What do you feel are the biggest sacrifices you've made either in your personal or professional life in order to get where you are today? So if, Catherine, I'll give you, we'll start from this end and work our way down, just to be totally fair and diplomatic.
And I actually took a peek at the questions this morning, so I might be a little more prepared. Yeah, I'd say time on my sailboat would be top of my list for sacrifices. So I guess, you know, raising a family, raising two girls, and having a career as a physicist and academic. It was a pretty full life, and I used to... A pretty full life and an interesting life in the sense that each complemented the other. I would be completely away from physics when I was with my family and completely away from my family sometimes when I was doing my physics. So I didn't need a whole lot more in my life, but I am a sailor and I do enjoy sailing and I don't spend nearly enough time on my sailboat as much as I'd like, but that would require a 36-hour day, and so that's what ends up not happening. So,
thank you. Ilse?
That's a hard one. Sleep deprivation, probably. I mean, I think, you know, maybe I'm just at the stage where you sort of look back at some of the chaos pragmatically. But, you know, if I had to have a sort of a wisdom of hindsight comment, I think the important thing is to just be a little patient. Although, you know, you can't have everything at once. And if you look at any point in time, you know, it's sort of a long, flat sinus curve. If you look at any point in time, something is totally out of whack. But if you can look at, you know, over a longer term, there is a more of a sense of balance. So I think one of the illusions, I think, is modern life you can achieve work-life balance. I mean, you can't. You have to think about it more as a lifetime of work and make time at various stages because even with four kids, you know, things change. There's a decade where you're real pretty immersed in having small kids and you have very little emotional energy available for a lot of other things. You know, where I am now, there's a lot more emotional energy available for work because the kids are at a different stage. So it's a bit of a foot on the brake, foot on the gas in terms of moderating both expectations and just energy across that space.
Thank you. Sarah?
I guess I don't feel that I've really sacrificed anything. I feel generally incredibly fortunate to have this opportunity to do, you know, what I've always wanted to do. There definitely is a sort of a trade-off in the sense that, you know, if you want to pursue your career, you go where your career leads you, to go undergrad, graduate, postdoc, and job, which means maybe you move away from your extended family, maybe you don't have a lot of stability in the short term. But I think that's just a trade-off because, of course, you get to explore, you get to see new places, meet new people. So I don't feel like there's been much sacrifice except sleep, probably.
Adriana?
For me, it's definitely time taking away from being with my kids. With two of my kids, I've taken very short maternity leaves because of my academic duties. With one of them, I've been at home just for 6 weeks, with another one, 5 months. I think, in general, the struggle of balancing career and family is there, and my kids are not old enough to have this emotional energy that my colleagues are talking about. I wouldn't call it a sacrifice because I love both my kids and my career, And since my husband is a physicist, we made this arrangement that we take turns working in the evenings. So it seemed to have worked for a number of years. And it was an arrangement fair for each of us. And it's a trade-off we made of a common agreement. So I can't complain.
Thank you. And Catherine.
Okay. Well, like many others here, I feel I haven't made very many sacrifices, but I guess there is one thing that does come to mind that is a really big one, and that's having only a single child. I can't connect this, or put all the responsibility completely on my career in science, because originally I never even planned to have children. It's connected to my own turbulent background and that. But I think it's partly also is connected to my career, and I'm very happy to say I think it's an era that has sort of passed by. When I was at your stage, I guess one of my key role models was Millie Dresselhaus at MIT. She's a very famous condensed matter physicist in my area, about 20 years senior to me. And, she would give advice to young women, and she did what she needed to survive. But one part of her story is she has four children, and they were all born on weekends, and she did not miss a single day of work. Now, even the logistics of that, it's either complete luck or there's an intervention there that most doctors would not take these days. I don't know. Those were the type of stories that did pass around when I was making, I would have been making these kind of decisions. And I was certainly back to work in less than a week. Although it all worked fine because, John and I were in the department. We brought in Anne and, it all worked well for us, but looking back, it is one. I'm so grateful. I do have my one daughter, but I would certainly have liked to have more children. I do think the culture, if I'd been in an environment where there's lots of women, having babies, it would have been different. And I'm happy to say, in our own department, I now have many young colleagues that have had lots of babies in the department. So I think things really have changed.
Thank you very much.
Could I add a quick comment and say that that's one of the biggest changes, and I think it's wonderful that maternity leaves are now much longer and people have the right to take them. And so just in case you think you have to come back on a Monday, in Ontario, in fact, by law, you can't return in less than 7 weeks unless you have a doctor's certificate. And and the EI coverages and the law basically say that the university must hold your job for up to a year, and that there is both maternity and parental leave, and that can be split between the two parents to some degree. And I think it's a wonderful advantage that Canada has as an environment for scientists in general.
Sure. Maybe just flipping the question around, I think it's important to recognize that, having a successful career in almost any demanding area today is high pressure. And so don't single physics out as somehow more punishing than other areas. I think that the challenge for young women is to navigate, that period of life, which is very challenging. Being in academe, there is this coinciding with the challenge to get tenure, typically when women have young children. But that's true in women trying to make it to law partner or many other jobs. So it's a somewhat universal challenge. I would also say, as women, we need to continue to be quite impatient with the struggle of workplaces to deal with women having babies. This is not a new phenomenon. Certainly we can adjust our workplaces to accommodate, this project of humanity.
Thank you very much. The last question that came through on Facebook before I open it up to the floor is, I remember reading a study, and we touched on this a little earlier, and I'm trying to resist from looking at Catherine's husband as sort of the example here, but I remember reading a study which reported that half of the women in physics are married to male physicists. Is this a reflection of a certain cercle de femmes or of a workload schedule that does not allow many other social activities. So in other words, the only people you get to party with are other physicists. What are the implications of such a figure in terms of women, women's career development? And there's a comment here, the precarious, low-paid positions of early career physicists do not really favor configurations where both partners are in such a situation, not mentioning the challenge of finding permanent positions for two people. Comments from the panel.
Okay, let me start maybe. I think actually, from my perspective at least, this phenomena is not just limited social circles. But more the advantage of being able to talk about your work or to talk about the things that really interest you more than just in the office. And I think that, at least for me, is a really, really interesting part. I have many friends with which I discuss physics all the time, but having one really good friend that I could discuss physics at breakfast with, that really has been fantastic. And it's also a source of support because it's somebody who knows very well what you're up to work-wise and what's going on and can say, yes, that's a great idea, you should be confident in your idea, or can say, okay, maybe you're off track there, things like that. So I think it's just a fact of the personality of a lot of us that we really like what we do, we like to talk about it all the time, and we need somebody who understands sort of our devotion to the subject and to these ideas.
As one of the people on the panel who isn't married to a physicist, and I'm actually married to someone I met in high school, so it wasn't limited social circles. But on the other hand, my husband did go to the University of Waterloo in computer science, and he has a bachelor's in mathematics. He didn't go to grad school, but it is perhaps a measure that our minds work similarly. I mean, he did train in mathematics. I did train in physics. So maybe that was part of the attraction even in high school. And actually, my husband loves to read about physics, and he attends many more perimeter lectures, the public lectures in Waterloo, than I have time for. So it's attraction and who you, you know, who you choose as a mate, there's a lot of factors involved. But obviously, if your minds are, or your thought processes are somewhat similar, that's going to help. In other ways, we're completely different personalities. He's a night person and I'm a day person, and that's a wonderful thing when you have children, as I discovered. So we tended only to meet for breakfast and dinner, and he would go off and work nights and I on computers, and I would work days. But after we had kids, it was a wonderful schedule, so that worked well.
Yeah, so like Sarah, I think Sarah hit on a strong point there of just, you know, the enjoyment of sharing something, you know, with your partner, you know, and we have to admit that, you know, if you're in mathematics or theoretical physics, to really be able to discuss those areas in depth typically requires someone with that kind of training. I think there's also lots of other advantages. I'm sure there's advantages, too, of being married to a non-physicist, but just to mention some of the advantages on this side, you know, I mean, my husband and I and our daughter actually, you know, attended a lot of conferences together. We have many wonderful memories of summers in Aspen. There's a theoretical physics institute at Aspen, and our daughter got to meet a lot of what we call physics kids, you know, many of whom are, you know, have both parents are physicists, although not all of them. And so I think actually we often found it easier to coordinate our travel. And I must say, you know, physicists do travel a lot. And, you know, a lot of our traveling was together as a family, and that was a very enjoyable aspect.
Thank you.
I just want to make a kind of complementary point in the sense that women who are married to male physicists sometimes are younger than their spouses, and it may happen that due to maternity or childcare responsibilities, they decide to take a break in their career. And then we have this process of returning back to work, which may or may not be that smooth. But the good news is that there are programs in Canada that, and there is also peer support for those that take a break from their career for family reasons. And there are also organizations that are supporting. There's an organization, I believe, for mother. Oh, never mind. Oh, maybe I'll stop here.
No problem. Thank you. And Ilse?
Well, I can't speak to the pheromones in physics labs, but this made me think of just a weird experience I had when I first arrived to do my PhD in Oxford and was the only woman for a number of years in a very large research group. And many of the British young men who had come into the postgraduate program had come from single-sex schools. And it was actually initially quite uncomfortable because many of them decided that they had to be in love with me, and they really weren't. It was just that I happened to be the only female they had spent, 18 hours a day with in a smelly chemistry lab. So I think there is one other thing is that, we also have to be careful about making sure that the small numbers of women who are in these environments are not subject to uncomfortable situations.
Yeah, the ratio is fine, but sometimes the attention is not.
Yeah.
Now, I'll open it up to the group, and I see a hand there, and then a hand there, and then I'll repeat the question. I'll continue to sweep, and I won't miss you at the back, I promise. And I'll repeat the question just because we're recording all of this. So, yes, please. So the question is there any difference between, when you supervise both male and female students, is there any difference in their success rate, and what kind of approaches do you use that are differently? There are two microphones, so if you can, to ask your question, if you can get up, I've repeated yours, that's fine, but for future questions, if you can rise and say the question in the
mic. I guess we can run around with the microphones, give us some exercise.
Yes, Melanie.
I would say in my experience there hasn't been a difference in success rate. And also in my experience, every single graduate student and every single postdoc is so different. Perhaps it's because I'm in a multidisciplinary area, and so they come with different backgrounds as well as different strengths. But as far as possible, I try to find the strengths of each student and actually build on those strengths. But no, overall, there's been no difference in success rates. And I would say in terms of trying to treat each student individually is a challenge when, if you have a relatively big lab, but it is important. And I think the cultural differences when you have students from all over the world are probably, for me, bigger than the gender differences.
Thank you. Catherine?
Yeah, well, I agree. I also, on average, I don't see a difference in success. I have both students and postdocs of, both female and male that are in various faculty jobs and other careers that they've chosen. I'd say, if I had to think of something that distinguished the groups by gender, I'd say it was a confidence level and really the ability to take it for granted that you belong where you are. And I certainly have noticed amongst my women students and postdocs, that they're more likely to display and express a lack of confidence. And also, it comes through that there's, less of just taking for granted that you do belong where you are. And I think this goes along with having the small numbers, just the larger numbers for males reinforce that they, should be there if they want to. And it also can be other, I know from talking about some of my students, they may have parents or relatives that are sending mixed signals, maybe other students, So I do think that women students do tend to get messages that can make them doubt whether they should continue on, and that's unfortunate.
Thank you. So if, just as an instruction, if you come up in queue behind either of the mics, I'll rotate between this one, this one, this one, this one. So, second question.
So, this is really known for their sense of humor, and yet a lot of us still try to make jokes when we give seminar talks at different universities. But I think a hallmark of bad humor is when we make jokes that are based on gender stereotypes. And I, as a student, I've been in a couple of talks where these things happen, and they kind of make me feel uncomfortable because a lot of times I'm like one of the only women in the seminar. And I'm just wondering, like, in future, do you think I should just keep quiet about the fact that I feel awkward about this, or whether I should say something, and if I should say something, who I should say it to?
Thank you.
Yeah, I think it would be useful to say something, because I think very often people don't know that they're making people in the audience uncomfortable. And certainly we've evolved so that, you know, showing pictures during your talk of naked breasts is no longer acceptable. And some of my colleagues did that 20 years, 25 years ago during lectures. So we are evolving. I would say, rather than ask the question during the lecture, that probably an email to the lecturer after the fact, just saying, you know, they might want to know that you felt a little bit uncomfortable with a gender-based joke, and, you know, you just thought that they might want to know this, and just make it low-key, and I think it's more likely to have an impact in that way. That would be my guess.
That's interesting. I haven't thought about this, although I've encountered it a few times. I don't think it's, at least in my own experience, it's not that common anymore in physics, although it does occasionally happen. But I'm intrigued by this idea of whether it's better to take this low-key approach, or, you know, if you're actually willing to stick your neck out to say something publicly, because, you know, I guess one example that comes to mind, you know, wasn't too long ago, you know, involved a very senior Russian physicist, and I think their cultures, perhaps this is not fading as quickly in the Russian theoretical physics community as it is in North America. I don't think an email would have zero impact on this man. I know that for sure. So I just wonder, you know, if you said something publicly, it actually affects a lot more people and gets them thinking. I mean, just this question gets me thinking, and it makes me think that when I encounter that, I should say something such that students don't have to say something and feel uncomfortable, and that they know that there are senior people that are sensitive to this and that will stick up for them.
Thank you.
Hi. So there's been a lot of talk about family and pregnancy and how those have been big challenges in your careers. I'm wondering if it would be preposterous to propose that maybe the discrepancy in the populations goes much further back. So maybe in the development of a child and how a boy is given a truck which moves and has different parts to it, and a girl is handed, you know, a doll or a drawing kit or something like that. Is it ridiculous to think that that would affect how our brains work and how, you know, I understand a lecture given to me by a male prof versus a female prof, or is that actually a possibility?
I can say that in this report that was generated through NSERC, issued in November 2010, one of the recommendations is to be more inclusive in terms of how young boys and young girls are raised so that they break down those stereotypical barriers. But I'll put it to the panel for their comments as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly not crazy. I think a lot of factors come in, and I think factors from childhood certainly do enter. Certainly by the time you get to high school, you know, there's already a gender difference in what they think they might do with their future between boys and girls. So, yeah, I think it's one of many factors.
And I have two girls, and I was always astounded when people who had one girl and one boy used to attribute any differences between their children to the gender difference. And I had two girls, and they couldn't be more different. And so it was always interesting to me, because obviously it wasn't their gender that was different between them at all. And so, one is very academic and loves to read, and the other one is a kinesthetic learner and reads one book a year. And, you know, they, in all kinds of ways, they're very, very different people. I was very sensitive having two girls, of course, when they were growing up. And so a couple of battles that I had to take on in terms of their rights to do certain things. So one was in daycare, and she wasn't allowed to play on the baseball team that they put together at the daycare center. And I made a point that, you know, it wasn't like she had a choice about being at the daycare center, and so therefore she was going to be allowed to play on this team with the boys if that's what she wanted to do. So I do think there are a lot of stereotypes that happen early. I think a lot of the studies show that fundamentally boys and girls aren't any different in their abilities to do math and physics very early on. And so, yeah, we have to watch out for that stereotyping of by gender.
Ilse.
So I grew up in a very patriarchal environment, and my brother was always named as the better at sciences. So I was very sensitized to all of this when I became a parent. Had two girls and two boys, and I thought environment is really critical. My husband, who is possessed about his childhood trucks, had a collection of trucks that he had carefully preserved. The two daughters arrived first. They had absolutely no interest in the trucks. The boys arrived, and they went to sleep with trucks in their hands every day. So I don't know the answer anymore. but it was a bit of a sobering, I think we, if anything, bend over backwards not to reinforce those small stereotypes.
Although when you mentioned that, you know, there's a lot of controversy recently in the Toronto Star about a baby being brought up genderless. And,
yes.
You know, what struck me was how strongly people feel, you know, the desire to that they need to know the sex of a one-week-old baby. And you know, studies show that their tone of voice, whether it's higher pitched or lower pitched, and that depends then on the information they're given about the sex of the baby. So, yeah, I don't know. I think there could be a lot of unconscious things going on that it can make a difference.
Maybe I can also add, which goes back to an earlier question, too. We don't know, I don't think, what makes a good physicist, really. Lots of things make a good physicist. And the most interesting thing about being in a group of good physicists is that they all think very, very, very differently. And one of the most important things my advisor told me as a student, where I was the only girl, and I watched all of these guys who seemed to think in a similar way, he said, you know, you don't have to think like that. You think how you think, and that's fine. And so I don't think we should get too caught up, since we don't know at this moment whether playing with a truck makes you a good physicist or not. Let's not get caught up in that, right? You think how you think, and if you think well and in a creative way, you're going to be a good physicist. So that matters more.
Thank you.
Hi. So I wanted to open up an argument that I constantly have with my mom, who's a college professor, and my sister, who's a chemical engineer. And that's the difference between equity and equality, so equality that we're all equal and we should be treated the same, versus equity that we are different and we should all try to receive the equal opportunities but get treated differently. So it's the example, in case anyone doesn't know, of you build stairs so people get into a building, but because some people can't walk, you have to build a ramp so they get up. So it's getting the same opportunity but different ways to do it. So my question for you all is sort of what needs to be done about this, or sort of do women need to be treated differently to reach the same ends in physics, and if so, how?
Thank you. We're solving all the problems of the world here. This tape will go out.
Yeah. Well, I don't know a global answer to that, but and certainly, you know, I can say there's examples where people thought women had to be treated differently, and in fact, it just turned out that everyone had to be treated differently. And I think this issue of having babies and childcare and maternity leaves is an example of that. Historically, it was considered very much the women's issue of the fact that you have a family and children. And I think these days, if I look at my own department, we have someone currently on paternity leave. We've had people on maternity leave. And I think, recognizing that people have families and need time for caring for young babies, has made it better for everyone, and that it's not solely a woman's issue. So I think sometimes people might put things in the category of treating women differently, and it's really not looking creatively enough that everyone could benefit from something different.
Yes, and I would say that equity is very important, and flexibility. And I always worry that universities are large institutions and they have a tendency to become inflexible as a result. And I think the more flexibility that you can treat people with to suit their own situation, the better off you are in terms of encouraging everybody to do their best and pulling in the most excellent people. So equity is rather than equality, but not necessarily a different treatment of women, just a different treatment of individuals who need that treatment for whatever reason.
Hello.
Hello. So people have pointed out many ways that women feel singled out, for either it be the center of romantic interest, or like when, among friends, you don't get taken seriously, or colleagues, you don't get taken seriously, just like you, people are used to segregating the gender in a social setting. Or the fact that maybe you are experiencing more family obligations and people treating you differently. So now, sort of following this line of being treated differently. At the moment, So somehow at the moment when women realize that behind this, I mean, some certain people at least have the impression that you should be doing worse than men. Like, there's certain people who have this negative thoughts about women, then you suddenly, you know, people like students at various stages, the lacking confidence or whatever, will suddenly lose their ability to think it's possible, right? So, I mean, first, like, to what extent, like, I guess for people on the panel who made it this far, to what extent do you think oblivion is blessed to you? So that's the first question. The second question, I've noticed at least among mathematicians, women sometimes exhibit a collective certain characteristics, and it's a positive one. Sometimes, you know, there's certain positive ways about the way women think. So, you know, the difference doesn't have to be negative. It could revolutionize science or mathematics the way it's done by men before. So you don't have to think this, like I'm agreeing with Sarah, that you don't have to be the same, but, you know, sometimes in some way it can be better. But so maybe get back to the first question, to what extent do you think being, like, oblivious to the situation, the people's expectation of women doing worse, is helpful in your career and blissful?
So in summary, as I understand it, the first question is, can being oblivious to the fact that you yourselves don't make an issue of being a woman, how can that help an individual in their career? And the other question, as I understood it, is if people say there is a different way of thinking that women have, how can it benefit their particular pursuits in science, acknowledging the fact that sometimes women may be perceived to think differently or along different lines than men?
I'll tackle the first question. I think, you know, being oblivious, you know, to the fact that you might be treating differently in that, I mean, there certainly can be positives of that. And I think, you know, studies show, I guess I recall a study, I think it was on some tests where they told white male students that Asian students did better on that test on average, and it actually affected, you know, if the males that were told that, the white males that were told that, did poorer on the test. So, just someone telling you that you're expected to do more poorly can certainly affect you, and so if you just block that out, obviously that's a benefit. On the other hand, I also think, you can gain a lot by spending time talking to other women in your situation and just trying to get to know other women physicists as well as you can. Because I think, you know, if you're completely oblivious, that's one thing. But, you know, you can be oblivious and yet it's still affecting you, like you're not completely oblivious. And I think that can be quite a damaging state where you're internalizing it and you're not really aware of it. And by getting together with other women and sharing stories and hearing the way they perceive it, and that you can learn a lot, that it's not you, that it has nothing to do with your merit and talents and abilities, and you may come up, you know, with ways of dealing with it. So I think probably trying to maintain the state of obliviousness is a bit of a difficult and dangerous task, and I would tend to go for the open and aware and sharing stories and communicating with other women.
Yeah, I would say that being oblivious is helpful sometimes, or at least treating it with humor if it's not really bothering you. So I would say pick your battles. Like, if you become aware of an issue, as was said earlier, you know, if you can avoid a certain person or not, you know, not work on a committee with a certain person, if you can change the situation slightly so that you know, you're not dealing with it on as often or on a daily basis, then that's positive. Really, I found I had to pick my battles. I didn't have time to battle, you know, this sort of the times that I wasn't viewed as positively as I could be, and also keep up with the physics I wanted to do. And very often I made a conscious choice that, you know, I was just going to avoid a certain situation and work on the physics. That's what I loved doing, and that's what I was going to do. So you make choices, and but it is important ultimately to be in a supportive environment. And, you know, in spite of those comments made in the tea room at ANU, in the department I was in, you know, it was for me as a student a wonderful environment. I mean, I went to Australia because I didn't have to take courses and because I didn't have to do a TA, and I could immerse myself in research, and they were very bright people, and the department was enormously supportive of students in general. You know, students were their lifeblood and were the source of all new ideas. And so, you know, I had to balance those two things, you know, and in the end, the balance was it was enormously supportive for me for the things I wanted to do.
I tend to agree with Melanie, and I kind of make it as one of my lifelong rules to pick my battles and be as diplomatic as I can, because whether we like it or not, conflict will arise in a workplace, and handling conflict and handling stress in a work environment is a very important skill, being able to handle the stress and being able to tackle a conflict in a very diplomatic way, because sometimes there are things beyond your control, and you have to be able to handle them on your own.
In chatting yesterday at the reception with a number of you, it came to the fore that for all of the inroads we've made in North America, you know, breaking down the barriers for women in science, that in fact other countries are doing much, much better than we are. And given your contact with your international colleagues, I wonder if I can put to you, because I know we're running out of time, and so if, as the last question is chair's prerogative, if I can put to you, can you give an example of a country or countries where, you know, women don't have to walk in wearing a T-shirt saying, yes, I'm a woman and a scientist?
Well, I guess France stands out as one country that has many more women physicists, although, you know, when I talk to some of the women physicists, they still talk in terms of what you might call a glass ceiling, that, you know, the most prestigious and you know, the positions with the most power and resources are still predominantly occupied by men, and that women aren't represented, you know, in the proportion that you would think from their numbers of career physicists and that. So, you know, I think even in the countries that stand out, there probably, you know, are still roadblocks that they encounter at some stages. And actually, as to why that is, I mean, people point to Marie Curie, and, you know, it certainly is a role model. I don't know, it could be their, you know, their culture. I think, you know, in France, it's not, you know, it's considered good to be scientifically literate and that. So there certainly are differences in the culture, but, you know, I don't understand completely why the numbers are so different.
My favorite comment is Marie Curie was so successful because she married well. So, Adriana, any countries that...
I think Portugal, as far as I know, has the highest number of percentage in female PhDs in physics. And I don't quite know why that is, but I do know that Portugal still, as France mentioned, has this still gender biased issues, and they still have internal problems. That's all. I can also speak of the former communist countries where the percentage of women in science was larger than we know in North America. And even so, the regime has changed. I think there is still a high percentage of women, over 30% in sciences.
Thank you. Sarah?
Yeah, I guess I don't know of any country where I've met a lot of people that would say overall it's much better, but I guess maybe I just want to point out that it's very interesting when you meet colleagues from around the world, women or men, to ask them or to find out a bit about what their experience has been, because people have very, very different experiences, and you can learn a lot by finding, you know, this person had to deal with this, and this is what happened, or this person just assumes that this is a fact, and this is the result. So it's good just to get as much, learn as much from a variety of people as you can.
Sorry, Elsa?
I have to say, you know, as somebody who left the formal world of chemistry and of an occasion over the last few years of went back to talk to or meet with chemistry audiences, I am struck by how little things have changed, how the number of women in the audiences are still the same as they were. So I feel a bit uncomfortable with some of the conversation here, because I think we have to continue to be vigilant. And this is not just true in the science. I mean, a lot of the enrollment numbers are going in the wrong direction at the moment, aside from the life sciences. The number of women on corporate boards are going in the wrong direction. There's a lot of areas where we are not making as much progress as we can. And yet the world is changing so fundamentally, and I think women have a huge amount to offer. The larger conversation of how we're going to tackle the complex problems that are in front of us. But, you know, the progress is not going to come unless we claim it and go after it.
I would say I know some very high-profile women in Spain, so that's been my European experience. I don't actually know the figures for the number of PhDs, but I know some people in positions of you know, directorships of national labs, some women. So that, to me, is a good sign. And I don't know that I don't understand well enough the cultural differences. I think there have been some studies that indicate there are cultural differences and differences that affect women, in, as Ilse said, in all kinds of jobs. So, you know, there just aren't that many visible women, say, even at high-profile positions in government in Canada. And so we really do have still some way to go, as she says, and we have to try to figure it out. And I would talk, I would say in that context that outreach is very important. You know, I know Perimeter and IQC are doing a lot of outreach, and lots of faculty members do it, but it is important that we try to do outreach into the school system, particularly since many teachers are not trained in science, and so we have to give, you know, male and female students some experience of science early on so that they can fall in love with it the way we did.
Thank you. I know that some of you didn't get an opportunity to ask your questions. Hopefully the panelists will, well, certainly a number of the panelists will be here throughout the next few days. I remind you that Adriana is giving a talk on Thursday, again, dealing with the intersection point of being a scientist, having a full life, and how to do that better. Please join me in thanking the panelists today, Catherine, Adriana, Sarah, Ilse, and Melanie.